obviously one of the probably the most pivotal war of our time, and I think we'll look back at it as, you know, the people that served in World War II, and as we get close to Veterans Day, to me it's always was, I just can't believe how brave those people were, knowing that, I don't know, if we didn't win this thing, you know, we've been in other skirmishes, but this was one that if we don't win, the world changes, a lot in the world changes, and how different would it be now? I always think about that. It's like, and then would they, you know, if they would have won Germany and Italy and Japan, I'm guessing they would have turned on them, and who knows what would have happened to our planet. And part of the reason I was excited to do an interview with Robert Fowler is that his dad actually lived through part of it. And my grandmother, I don't know if you know this, Robert, but my grandmother, my mom grew up in Germany, and my grandmother actually died during the war in Germany. So I feel like there's a connection instantly when I started reading about your book, The Gun Club, USS Duncan at Cape Esperance. He's Robert Fowler. How you doing, Robert?
I'm great. That's an amazing connection. I hadn't really ever heard that one before. That's she died in Germany during the war?
My mom was 14 when her mother my mom got moved out of the city to the country. She was in Mannheim, and her mother was working in a factory, and you know, they knew where they were going to drop the bombs, munition places, so it was pretty safe. So her father would actually sleep in the apartment when the bombs were going off, but her mother was scared, so she went to this bunker. Well, when the pilots were done, they dumped their bombs if they had some extra. Well, one just happened to be dumped in this facility where my grandmother would have been staying. And, you know, war is just, it's horrible on all sides. And I love to hear the stories, though, because it humanizes.
Well, it's so interesting because I know the English side of that story quite well, because an uncle of mine was a bundle from Britain who was initially sent out of London, you know, to the countryside. He was about 11 or something. And then they moved him to America. And he became sort of part of my family for a while.
Interesting. Wow. And it just connects all of us, don't you think? How are you doing, Robert?
I'm doing great, thanks.
So you have this amazing journey. When did you start taking the journey to discover about your own father?
Well, that's a really good question. I guess, I knew from a very young age that there was something fishy about his death. I'd come into the room as a child, and people would be talking about my father, and they'd suddenly stop talking. You know, and I realized there was something they weren't talking about. But 40 years later, my mother was invited to a reunion of the Duncan crew. You know, these guys never talked about the war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after they retired, and their grandchildren started asking questions. And then all these ships started having reunions at more or less about the same time. It's interesting. You know, like 40, 50 years after the war.
Yeah.
So my mother said she'd go to the reunion if I did. And so we went down to Fort Lauderdale and sat in a motel for, you know, a few days listening to these guys talk and drink and reminisce. And, well, the big realization then was that I realized none of them knew what had happened either. Hmm. This battle was a night battle, pitch black night. And everybody on ships, you know, has a job they're supposed to be doing. They're not supposed to be looking around and see what's going on. So even the guys on deck hadn't really seen anything. And these ships passed at like 40, 50 miles an hour, really. So it all happened extremely fast, and there were flares going up, which distorts the light as they're coming down. You think you're seeing ships rolling over, but they're just turning or something. So it's very hard to lock down what happened in a night battle. And plus, they're like tank battles in the desert. You know, there's no markers. Just, you know, you really never know where you are exactly relative to other ships. And so it's all very complicated. And then it was more complicated on this ship because they have a guy called a war diary recorder who's supposed to follow the captain around and record everything he orders and record everything that happens to the ship. And he was killed, and his papers were all burned up. So, you know, it became progressively more complicated for even, you know, the guys after, you know, immediately after the battle when they had to write battle reports. They were all kind of stumbling around trying to figure out what had happened. And they only knew what had happened in their own little area.
So,
in other words, it was a complicated thing.
As it always must be. You know, I look at it. I mean, this was the first, one of the first battles that we encountered with the Japanese, part of Guadalcanal, as I was reading about. And I was going to ask you while you were talking, how long were you Did you miss your dad, and was it really difficult, or was it something you were at peace at, or did all of this really help you make peace?
You know, he was killed before I was born, and I think it's easier for... I never knew what having a dad was. You know, it wasn't like something I missed. I think it's worse if he dies when you're six or something.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the loss, and you always have the memory. I never really had a memory of any kind, so... people bent over backwards to, buck me up as if, like, I was suffering. But also in school, you know, there were always three or four other guys in the class who lost their fathers in the war, too. You know, so it wasn't a total traumatic thing, I got to admit.
So tell me about these guys. You went to the reunion the first time. You said, was it 91? Was that when you went the first time?
That was about 91, yeah.
And what was it like to meet these guys? Because, you know, we find that a lot of veterans just don't want to talk. They want to keep it in because, obviously, there are things they witnessed.
This was the first time. A lot of their wives came with them, and the wives were amazed because they'd never heard their husband talk about the war at all in whatever, 40 or 50 years, whatever they were married. And so they were totally amazed to hear them suddenly start talking about it like it was this whole part of their life they didn't even know about. It was really quite touching, that part of it.
And when you went there, obviously, how old were you then? When you were a kid, right back then, or
when are you talking about?
When you went? Oh, when 1991?
The reunion? Oh yeah. No, that was I was 40 or something.
So you were an adult, and did they bring you right in, accept you right away?
Because my father died, and my father was the torpedo officer on the ship, and he was killed in the battle, and or actually died as a result of wounds from the battle a day later, So they were very, they sort of adopted me. When they realized I was really seriously trying to figure out what had happened, then they were all on my side because they wanted to know what had happened too. And the interesting part was they all had a little piece of the puzzle. They all had their little area and knew what had happened, you know, what they had done. And they just never talked to anybody else on the ship who had, it was all a big revelation to them. And they were thrilled and had about 10 more reunions after that. Which I went to every one of them year after year.
That's really awesome, the connection that
and
you made.
I would go to their they'd invite me to their homes, and I'd go and stay with them for a weekend.
Really? Wow, that's neat.
Record them. So I have an endless number of recordings of them just reminiscing about the war. So
a lot of people, what I find unique about this, too, is that, you know, we think we hear about all the battles and all the... And I'm sure most people are not going to know about the destroyer. Wasn't it a destroyer, the USS Duncan?
Yeah. The thing that's interesting about this battle, there had been battles before this. Coral Sea and Midway had happened. But those battles, the two fleets kind of stumbled into each other and did the best they could. This was the first battle where the Admiral had a plan. And every battle after this, the Admiral had a plan. So it was unique that way. And the other thing that's really, you forget about in the Second World War, before the war, the Navy had a plan for how they were going to fight wars. And the plans all were built around battleships. And then Pearl Harbor came along, and suddenly the battleships were gone. And so they had to come up with a whole new way to fight a war using aircraft carriers and cruisers and destroyers. Cruisers and destroyers had always been used up to that point as convoy escorts and protection, submarine, anti-submarine protection, that sort of thing. And suddenly since the battleships were gone, they had to move the cruisers and destroyers up to be a fighting force of their own. So eventually, a month into the Guadalcanal campaign, they realized they were not going to be able to win this battle on land without shutting off the Japanese fleet from being able to land supplies and men on Guadalcanal. So they created this cruiser-destroyer force of four cruisers and five destroyers, and sent them out to try to intercept a Japanese supply fleet coming down to resupply Guadalcanal. And that's what they were trying to do.
How many men were on the ship and how many were lost?
240 were on the ship and 39 were lost, I think.
Well,
quite a few in the battle and a few in sharks in the water and drowning and things like that. We never found out what happened to them. They just vanished.
That's amazing.
Probably sharks.
That many guys made it. And I just wonder how much fear these guys must have, I mean, did they tell you about the fear they faced when they were going through this, or did they not even think about it because things were happening so fast?
They never really talked about that, but what they did talk about a lot was the difference between fear and cowardice. They thought the whole concept of fear and cowardice, or heroism and cowardice, was a concept for people who never been in battle, basically, because there were a lot of cases on this ship, for instance, where when the shells first started coming in, a guy would completely freak out and start crying and hide in a locker or something and just behave like a complete coward. And then half an hour later, he was doing something incredibly brave that you know, nobody else would go near. So, you know, there's a couple of guys like that who actually won medals in the end of it, because what they did finally was so brave that they could forget the cowardly part. So they think, you know, guys who've been through it think that, you know, that whole concept is a sham. Mm.
How do you think, this is what I put myself in when I start reading stuff like this, is how do you think you'd react if you were placed in that position?
You always wonder. Well, that's why men go to war. They want to see how they're going to react, I think. I think that's what it's all about.
It certainly, I think, you know, I listened to my mother when she talked about, you know, the bombs being dropped and things happening. And you know, Hitler almost was going to annihilate his own people. If the generals would have followed through, he would have starved his own people.
And
to hear my mom talk about it, and maybe this is something you got from the soldiers, from the guys in the Navy, you didn't have a choice. You know, you had no other choice but to live and to survive.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's the way they looked at it completely. I mean, they would. You know, what was worse to them was the boredom of being stuck in a port. You know, they'd be sitting in a port in some incredibly hot, you know, miserable place, and they'd be there for 12 days, 13 days or something, and, you know, the days just got so incredibly tiring that they just wanted to head for the battlefront as soon as quickly as possible. You know, when they finally took off for the Pacific, started heading out to the Pacific, they were all thrilled to be moving again. So it's just, and you know, you forget these guys were, 90% of the guys on the ship were guys who grew up during the Depression. They had never been able to get a job. And when the Navy finally opened up in, you know, 1940, I guess it was, you know, they all rushed to sign up because that was a great opportunity for them. And it created a whole different kind of Navy because these were guys who wanted to advance themselves. The Navy had been this, you know, it was made up of guys who really didn't give a damn. They just wanted to drink and fight and, try not to miss their ship when it left port. But this new generation of Navy was a new thing the Navy hadn't really ever seen because they'd never had the opportunity to get the best people. And now, you know, now everybody wanted to be in.
And so tell us about the battle, because that's amazing. It's what little I've read about it. And I didn't even know about this. And if you go right, you can Google it about your father and find out that it does mention him as being the torpedo gunner. Officer. I don't know what they called him.
Torpedo officer, yeah.
And it's a fascinating story. And to me, it's just, you know, I'm fascinated by how people handle somebody gets knocked, you know, blown up to pieces and somebody else steps in to take their place.
Yeah, it is amazing, isn't it? Well, the Navy is so well organized. You know, it's amazing. Every single thing is written down. You know, there's a way to do it. There's the Navy way is the way everything's done, and they practice so much that when the battle actually comes, a lot of guys said, you know, when the battle actually happened, they didn't really think about anything. They just, you know, they did it so automatically because they didn't done it so many times before in practice.
Okay.
And it was just like it rote. They were just going through this. And the shells coming, you know, even when the shells coming in, they'd watch the shells coming. The guys on deck would, you know, in the stern of the ship, could see the shells coming, you know, these giant glowing objects rattling through the sky and crashing around them. And every time they crashed around them, they'd make a dye in the water. Each American cruiser had a different color dye that their shells made. So you know exactly whose ship, you know, whose shells are, you know, coming toward
wow,
you.
Wow, really? That's interesting. So do you mind telling us a little bit how this battle started and what happened to the USS Duncan?
Okay, so they were going out to intercept this Japanese fleet that was coming in. Their plan was to come in, like, after, you know, about 11 o'clock at night and trap the ships against the shore was the idea. And they did that. The approach was fine. They weren't spotted by the Japanese or anything. And they got to the point where they were going to try to trap them against the shore, but they didn't. The plane that was supposed to drop a flare on the ships in that area had crashed and burned as it was taking off. So there was no light to light the shore. And so they didn't know if they were there or not. And then as they got closer, the admiral started panicking because he thought they could see the Allied fleet better than we could see them against the dark shore. So then he panicked, and he headed out to sea a little bit, hoping to intercept the entire fleet. They had accounted for two or three of the ships that were in this Japanese fleet, but there were some missing still. So he went out a little bit to wait for the other ships to come in. And the battle plan was that when the destroyers saw, the destroyers were in the front, three destroyers were in the van, and when they saw the Japanese fleet, they were supposed to charge at them without orders and fire torpedoes and then light their lights and shine them on the Japanese ships so that the cruisers with the bigger guns could take them under fire. That was the plan. But they were also told not to use their radios because the Japanese could zero on the radios, it was thought. Turned out that wasn't true. But that was what thinking was. So they were told not to use their radios until, unless it was something really crucial. So nobody reported anything. And the Duncan radar found the Japanese fleet on radar. And the captain kind of got very confused because he could see the Japanese fleet was closing on us, on them. And yet nobody had reported them to the admiral. And so his thought was that must be because they were told not to use the radio. And the ships started turning, the other ships started turning, so he assumed that was why they were turning. And it turned out it was just completely accidental that they started turning at that point. And so the Duncan started heading for the Japanese fleet on a torpedo run, and assuming that all the other ships were going to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, none of the other ships did follow. And the Duncan wound up between the two fleets and was taken into fire by both sides.
Wow.
And the worst damage was from the American fleet, who thought she was Japanese.
Wow.
So it was all a very confused battle. But the interesting part about it, well, the two interesting things about the book, I think the thing that amazes the military historians is that it's so personal. You really get a feeling on this, what it was like to be on a destroyer. During the war, you know, it's like when I first got to that first reunion. One of the things that really amazed me is guys told me that when they first read the Kane Mutiny, they thought it was about the Duncan, and that made a big impression on me because as I started putting the story together, there was a lot of incidents, like the strawberry incident on the Kane Mutiny is, there was an equivalent thing with stolen food. All those things always involve stolen food because everybody was starving to death. And so if there's any food laying around, it was going to disappear quickly. And the officers arranged to get themselves a ice cream freezer. But they proceeded to use up all the ice on the ship every day because to make their ice cream. So it became a huge thing of contention with the whole crew because they... It was incredibly hot, and they had no ice for their iced tea. All the ice was going to make the captain's ice cream. So there were a lot of things that were similar, but that may be that every ship there's instances like that.
I would think so, right? Because you're going to have,
I wrote Herman Wouk, who's the author of the Kane Mutiny, and I wrote him a letter once and asked him if there was any, because the ship he was on was a destroyer minesweeper called the Zane, and it steamed with the Duncan for a while off Guadalcanal, and I always imagined that. These officers would get together in the officers' club and at night and drink and talk about their ships. And I always imagine that he must have heard stories about the Duncan and adapted it to the Kane Mutiny. But he wrote me back this scrawled note and said, "I'm sorry, I'm 101 years old and I don't remember anything." That was the end of that.
So this amazing story is these guys really went into this battle pretty much on their own to start things off. And they were taking it from both sides. It's remarkable that the ship lasted as long as it did, and then some of the guys left the ship. And what I read a little bit of it on your website. Some of the guys stayed because they thought they could put out the fires and get it working again, yet they were kind of sailing with no control.
It was steaming with no control. The captain abandoned ship, leaving a lot of the crew on board. I'm not sure about most, but at least half the crew on board. But there were two different battles during this battle. The forward part of the ship was fighting a Japanese cruiser, and the after part of the ship was fighting a Japanese destroyer that was coming up toward their rear. And so they all saw a different battle. And that's another reason that made it so confusing.
And it's, you know...
But in the book, there's five, you know, it's the book's like 9 chapters, and 5 chapters are about the battle. And 1 chapter is about, like 8 minutes of the battle or something. It's like a very intense situation with a lot of things happening at the same time in different parts of the ship. And that's why the captain abandoned, because he couldn't get to the stern. So he abandoned, thinking everybody was gone off the whole ship. And whereas, you know, there were another 60 or 70 guys, you know, fighting fires at the stern. And they stayed on the ship for quite a long time trying to save it. And finally they got panicky because one of the places where they stored the shells, the handling rooms, was on fire. Fire was very close to it. And there'd been a lot of stories. In Pearl Harbor, there was a famous ship called the Shaw, I think it was, that fire got into its ammo locker and just completely exploded, killing everybody.
Yeah.
So they thought they saw that happening, so finally they abandoned. And then they swam away, and the ship didn't sink. And so finally, you know, some of them swam back and tried to get back on board again. But by then, you know, the ship was so high, they couldn't reach to get on board.
It's amazing that they stayed with it. I think, you know, that part that I read about these guys knowing that it's just a matter of time probably before that ship goes under or explodes, to work in that kind of pressure.
With a gamble. But a lot of these, you know, the thing that's amazing about the Navy is a lot of them couldn't, especially the professional Navy guys, a lot of them couldn't swim. And so they were really more afraid of the water than they were blowing up on the ship.
That's a good point.
One guy had to be wrestled off the ship. He was so, you know, he was so terrified of the water. And the other thing is, when they got in the water, there were Japanese all over the water, you know, trying to kill them in the water. You know, the battle continued.
You know, what I like about this story, too, about the Duncan, is you talked about how confusing it was. And I think sometimes people look at, you know, wars and battles and things like that, even life in general, and they think it's all so perfectly laid out. But
I know, you do, don't you?
Rarely is it the case. And anybody I've talked to that's been in battle, it can be very confusing as to what is really going on. It's not clear cut.
Yeah, I think so. That's really the truth of battles.
So let me ask you this, Robert, because my podcast is called Out There, and it deals a little bit with paranormal and just things, I think, that inspire people and make them feel good and many different topics. But have you ever felt, since you started doing this, have you ever felt your dad's presence or any kind of presence or anything connected to him being around this, maybe?
You know, I think I probably have. You know, I think I've talked to other guys who've written books, not so much about their father, but where their father was a character or something, and they didn't know their fathers. And what they ultimately all realize is that they're very like their father. You know, they think they're going to find out something dramatic, and you sort of find out you've met yourself in a way.
Mm.
You know, I think he was a lot like me.
Do you think that his presence is ever around you when you're writing these things or talking to these guys?
That could be. You know, I've always been, I'm open to that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's something there.
Remember those group of guys? Wasn't it the O'Sullivans? Remember those guys?
Yes, the O'Sullivans. They died on a ship that my father was actually, his ship actually steamed with, and on the way back from this battle that my father was in, their ship, the Juno, blew up on the way back.
So the Sullivan guys, there's rumors that their spirits are haunting some ship. I don't know which one it was, but, you know, because I really believe that sometimes...
If ever anybody's going to be haunting a ship, it would be them.
Yeah.
And I mean,
so,
that was really...
Yeah. And that's they changed the rules after that so that the brothers couldn't serve together like that because of what happened. What was it, 3 of them, I think, that lost?
There were 5 of them, wasn't it?
Oh,
quite
okay.
A lot. Was it only 3?
I don't know. It's been a while since I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, me too. They made a movie about it years ago.
But I guess what I find amazing about all of it is that we are, You know, we're all on this journey, and you look and see what people do in their life. And this generation was called forward to step up to answer one of the biggest calls ever, you know, in the whole world.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did. And I'm sure there are many of them that were afraid or fearful. And
yeah.
Some of them might have ran the other way. And it's part of just being human.
And you know, my father and his friends, my father went to Harvard, and he was kind of an Anglophile. And he went in because, you know, to save brave little England. That's really what he was for.
Okay.
And there were a lot of guys in his class who felt the same way about France. They were in to, you know, save poor little France. And, you know, they wound up in the Navy and never got close to France or England.
Right.
That was their initial, you know, purpose. And they were the guys who were in before Pearl Harbor. The Duncan was mainly guys who were in before Pearl Harbor. But, you know, a month or two after the Duncan arrived in the Pacific, they started running into ships that were guys that, you know, joined up because of Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
And that was the bulk of the people who filled the Navy after that, just to get even for Pearl Harbor.
What do you know about your father? I mean, have you kind of put together, you said now you feel like you're a lot like your father. So you learned a lot of the type of person he was.
Well, you know, you got to remember, he was still a kid. He was 23 when he died. He was 22 when he went into the Navy. And, you know, so he was still trying to figure out who he was. And I suspect he wanted to be a politician. My mother was from a kind of patrician New York family, the Fishes. And Hamilton Fish was Secretary of Treasury or something under Grant. And so they were kind of an old-line New York political family. And so the fact that he married my mother, I always thought was kind of an indication that he might want to be a politician one day. Mm. But he never got there.
Never got that opportunity. Instead, he died. How long into that battle, how long did before he was...
He was wounding from the second or third shell hit the mast of the ship and sprayed shrapnel down on everybody on the top decks. He was on the deck above the bridge where the torpedo director was located. And so everybody on that deck was badly injured or wounded or killed. And and then guys came finally. They finally found him kind of... And they thought he was dead. The people who were with him checked him out and thought he was dead and left him there, and they abandoned ship. And people coming down from up above, you know, the gun control area up above the bridge, were coming down and heard moaning in the dark. And they went over to investigate and found him lying there asking for help.
Yeah.
And so they trussed him up and lowered him over the side into the water. And then some guys stayed with him in the water for the night. And finally, well, actually, they got tired of he kept falling asleep, and he kept slipping out of his life jacket and having to be dragged up again. And he was unconscious, so he didn't. And they finally found some three mess attendants. Mess attendants in those days were always black. And they were always very close to the officers because their whole life was surrounded by waiting on the officers. So they offered their mattress. They had mattresses. They offered a mattress to my father, and they hauled him up onto the mattress. It was very difficult because he kept slipping off, and I guess loading an unconscious person onto a floating mattress is difficult.
Mm.
But anyway, that took a while, and they finally got them on, and then the two guys who had been with him up to that point left him, and left him with the mess attendants who stayed with him for the rest of the night.
Do you know how many ships were at that battle?
There were four American cruisers and five American destroyers. And on the Japanese side, there were three cruisers and two destroyers.
Okay.
And plus, there were also a couple of supply ships that were actually at Guadalcanal unloading all during this. So the unloading continued while the battle happened offshore. But the interesting thing about this is between October 12th, which is when this battle happened, and November 5th or something, like a month, there were four other battles. They were absolutely identical. They were trying to do exactly the same thing, same kind of setup, cruisers and destroyers, and running into each other right off Savo Island in exactly the same spot. And that's why the Navy really never investigated this battle at all, because the battles were happening so fast that and they were so identical that it was hard to keep up, you know, from people who were 10,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that things could have gone differently could have been handled differently, or is anybody, in any way, do you feel anybody's kind of to blame for what happened to the USS Duncan, or is that just what happens when you're at sea and in the middle of war?
You know, when I started this book, researching this book, I thought, my mother was convinced the captain had gone off to be a hero and gotten them all sunk. And she was incensed every time she'd hear about the captain of the ship being promoted. And he had a very successful career in the Navy. He was promoted and promoted and promoted and wound up retired as a vice admiral. He was the guy who commanded the, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he commanded the ships that cordoned off Cuba.
Wow.
And also when the St. Lawrence Seaway was opened for the first time, he was commanding of the ships, the first ships that went through the seaway. So he was a kind of a, he was a well-known force in the Navy. He'd been well-known even at the time of the Duncan because he was the captain of the 1926 U.S. Naval Academy football team and played end.
Hmm.
And so everybody knew his name. His name was Whitey Taylor. And he was famous because he'd, in the Navy, because his hair had turned white while he was at Annapolis.
Hmm.
At the age of 22, his hair turned white.
Wow.
So his name was Whitey Taylor, and he was famous, and he could get his way in the Navy by just saying, "I'm, you know, Whitey Taylor wants you on the phone," kind of thing, and people would answer the phone, and so he had a reputation for getting his way.
So you came to a different conclusion. Your mother wasn't too happy; she blamed him.
My mother suffered. She died every time he got promoted. I mean, it was really terrible.
Oh, jeez.
And it went on for years.
Oh, boy.
And I was gonna, you know, I guess when I started, I was gonna get Whitey Taylor kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
I was gonna tell the truth about Whitey Taylor. It turned out he'd done, you know, of all the people who were commanding ships in that battle, he was the one who did the right thing, and everybody else was the ones who, you know, had done the wrong thing. And so it, you know, I learned to live with Whitey Taylor.
So do you have any things inside you that, I mean, does it stir feelings up with you when you started researching and writing this book?
Does it stir feelings?
Yeah.
You know, what I feel is I'm very glad that I found out what happened. I didn't know that I cared that much, but I guess I really cared.
Yeah.
And it is a great story because it's you know, this ship, what the book really is, it's the story of every ship of that, you know, at that time in microcosm. They were all going through exactly the same thing, this learning curve, trying to figure out how to fight with, you know, all these things were new. Radar was, you know, had been in the fleet for 1 year at that point. Admirals hadn't even tried, you know, they didn't trust radar because nobody'd ever taught them about it because it was so secret. And so they'd never learned about it. So they had all these things on board that they didn't know how to use, didn't know what they were for. And what happened over the thing that's amazing about the Navy and what you really realize in this book, the subtext of this book is how the Navy learned to fight in the course of a year. They made a lot of mistakes, and they made some mistakes over and over until finally, you know, somebody figured out some little change that made all the difference. And that's really what the subtext of the book is.
It's an amazing piece of history, but also I just love the fact that it's also the human story. You know, and to me, that's always the most fascinating. I don't care what people are talking about.
You read most Navy books, they're, you know, it's about what the ship did. Mm-hmm. You know, they went there, they turned north, they went this, they did, they fire, started opening fire. And you forget, there's no mention of anybody actually doing something. It's like almost the ships are robots. But in those days, everything was, you know, there was a guy doing every single thing.
Yeah, probably a lot different now compared to the ships.
I guess it probably is, yeah, I can imagine.
But I just think it's amazing, and especially as we get closer to Veterans Day. Is that something that you hold close to your heart as well?
I do, yeah, I always have. Yeah, I have a soft spot for veterans.
Is there anything you'd like to say regarding that, now that you've really talked with these veterans that were on the Duncan?
Well, you know, I think everybody, every man, I think has this secret, you know, almost a wish that they'd been able to test themselves in battle. I mean, did you watch the Ken Burns thing, the Vietnam thing?
I caught a little bit of that, yep.
I mean, it was devastating. But and a lot of those guys said that, you know, they really just wanted to test themselves and see if they, you know, had what it took. I mean, it's a little silly in a way, but, I mean, these guys on the Duncan weren't doing that. They were, you know, they joined the Navy before the war started. You know, they weren't there to fight a war. They were there just because, you know,
they were bettering themselves, right? To make
bettering themselves. Yeah.
Because things.
But once you're on a ship, you go where the ship goes, and that's how you wind up in a war.
Right, and we were, you know, a lot of people maybe think the Depression was over, but it still was going on even into World War II. That's really what kind of kicked us out of it.
These guys, a lot of them talked about how the first time they got a check, you know, it was the first time in their life they'd ever gotten a check, and they were like 18 years old, and they had money, they could go ashore and buy beers and go to whorehouses and whatever they did.
So these men that were the crew that you talked to, did a lot of them get reassigned after the Duncan went down?
Yes, they got immediately reassigned onto another destroyer. And, you know, one guy I talked to was on three destroyers that all sank.
And, wow, you know, really?
But the interesting thing about it is, you know, as they went onto a new destroyer, half the crew, they'd split. In this case, the Duncan crew, they split the crew into two different ships. And one of them, the executive officer, was the new captain. And the other, the captain, was the new captain. And so half the people on the ship were people they knew from the Duncan on their new ship. Then when that ship sank, you know, the same thing happened. And now a quarter of the crew was on their new ship. And so they always thought they were on the same ship. In memory, it was all one big destroyer they were on. Yeah. And so they tell me stories about, you know, things on the destroyer that were happening. And I think, I never heard that story before. I don't know where that came from. And it turned out it was from a totally different destroyer. But a lot of the same people were involved. So it was very confusing for them.
So really, you couldn't wind up getting back stateside after you pretty much had to go back on another ship unless you were like injured in some way where you couldn't serve. So
yeah, that's what they were really afraid of. They were afraid they were going to be dropped on a ship, you know, and just put on a ship before they left the Pacific. But they actually went back with the captain to Philadelphia, had a month off for Christmas, had Christmas off, and then went back on another ship.
And they wanted to get back into the war, even though they experienced.
I think they would have been happy to stay home, but they, you know, I mean, you know, you forget. And this was now the beginning of 1943, and there were really no men at home. If you were a man walking down the street, people wondered what he was doing there, if he was military age. Mm. So it wasn't like Vietnam or anything. It was like, you know, you couldn't really hide.
Right, and I suppose. You know, there was a different attitude compared to where.
The thing is, they're friends. You know, these guys, after a year on a ship, you know, you've made a lot of very close friends, and especially after you've been through a battle with them, you know, it changes your whole attitude. You know, the Duncan crew and their officers didn't get along at all well until after the battle. And then once they'd been through the same thing together, there was sort of this camaraderie that suddenly evolved that they hadn't expected, and they were all kind of best friends. And the guys they hated were their new best friends. And
sometimes that's what it takes to bring us all together.
I think it takes to bring us all. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe true.
It's called The Gun Club, the USS Duncan at Cape Esperance. You can find the book at thegunclubbook.com. Anywhere else that you would recommend going to find your book?
No, it's easiest on Amazon, but it's supposed to turn up in bookstores soon. But I don't think it's there yet. It just came out. It just came out like a couple of weeks ago, so it's not. There's not a lot of promotion.
You've written some other books, I'm guessing. I know you've been done documentaries.
Well, I wrote screenplays and documentaries and things like that, yes. I came in from New York. I worked for CBS for a while, 60 Minutes, but I always wanted to make movies. And I produced a play off-Broadway. But movies were my goal, but I was a complete failure in the movie business. I wrote a lot of screenplays that never got made but got optioned. It's very annoying, the movie business, because you can make a living just optioning screenplays.
You know what would be ironic and an injustice is after, let's say, you leave this earth someday and then they make this into a movie.
I know.
And they go, hey, this is a great story. Let's make this into.
It actually would make a great movie or a great long form TV thing. Sort of like Band of Brothers in the Navy, kind of.
Well, it sounds very fascinating. I'm sure people will enjoy reading it. Is there anything else you want to tell me at all, Robert?
No, I think you've covered it. Can't think of a thing.
I guess I just want to say Happy Veterans Day.
It's a love story between my mother and father. That's, you know, not a large part of it, but the first and last chapters are. My mother was so devastated by his death that she went and joined the OSS and was sent to Spain as a spy.
Mm, wow.
So I think really she wanted to get herself killed.
Wow.
But so that's all part of it, too. Anyway, thank you very much for all this.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us. And again, if you want to find out more about it, it's the Gun Club, USS Duncan at Cape Esperance, part of the Guadalcanal battle, and a little piece of history. And if you're curious like I am about everything, including history, it sounds like it'd be a very interesting book to read. Thank you so much.